back, WNSG, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. You know, sometimes when you get a journalist on, you think, well, it might be some breaking news. Well, there was, and we had Pam Wood on. We're going to bring her back in here for a second segment as part of what we do. We're flexible here, Don Mohler, correct?
Baltimore Positive, that's what it's all about, being flexible.
Well, I want to give some love to some of our sponsors here as well. Taharka Ice Cream. I'm almost out of the Honey Graham again. I made the mistake of not getting the pistachio the last time. That will not happen when I'm back in the freezer in August over at Taharka, made in Baltimore. And very, very local. Just like our friends at Fadley's, you can ship those crab cakes all over the world. Just go to Fadley's.com. They're coming to Catonsville next year, where Don Mohler is as well. And State Fair, there for you on all of the hot days, even after the 4th of July and the parade that was and the fireworks that were. Shrimp and grits, chicken and waffles, our friends over at State Fair, open all day. I enjoy breakfast. You can get there late night and get a cocktail. And last but not least, our friends at Mohler and Gary Realty. Jeff Mohler, a part of Baltimore Positive WNST this week. You can check that out at WNST.net as well as in our buyatoyota.com audio vault. Don, I'm going to let you take the floor with Pam Wood here because we wanted to have her for like a full segment. There was breaking news. We didn't know what the breaking news was. We weren't allowed to ask her because she's a journalist, right? So we're putting this together as sort of the encore edition with Pamela Wood, correct?
The Pam Wood, the sequel edition. Pam, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you both for having me.
Yeah. Pam, when we did have you the other day, there was breaking news. You had to jump off. And then a day or two later, we find out that the breaking news was that the governor began to release chapters of his book. And I think it's only fitting that we start with that because you and other journalists have written some articles that are, say, less than complimentary about some of the fact-checking in the book. And you came right out of the box with that. I wonder if you can walk us through with some of the things in the five chapters that you've seen so far that don't appear to add up.
Yeah, so I appreciate the flexibility. I was waiting that morning we were recording for those chapters to drop. The five chapters from Hogan's book still standing that relate to the death of Freddie Gray and the days that followed. And certainly part of it is going to come from his perspective. So, of course, he casts himself as the hero in these chapters, that he was the one who stepped in the absence of strong city leadership, in his opinion. But there were some things that didn't quite add up to us in terms of just factual, not perspective or interpretation, but just some of the facts didn't add up. For example, he said that Freddie Gray was a Crips-connected drug dealer, and that's the first time I had heard the word Crips associated with Mr. Gray. Gray, of course, was the 25-year-old young man who was detained by police, thrown into a police van.
So Hogan's literally calling him a gangster. He's a member of a gang.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
And you know, Freddie Gray was fatally injured and died a few days later, and now he did have a record. He had been arrested various times for kind of low-level drug offenses. So, you know, possession using, he allegedly had enough to get a possession with intent charge. But a lot of his charges were dropped. He never did serious jail time. So, but that was out of nowhere. And we asked the governor's people, well, how do you know this? And they said, well, this is just what he remembers from the time. And there were a few other things. And another one that jumped out at us, you'll recall that a bunch of pharmacies were looted and drugs, pharmaceuticals were taken from pharmacies across the city on the worst night of violence following Freddie Gray's death. And the governor said in his book that gangs split up the territory and said, you get this drugstore, I'll get that drugstore. And we had never at all heard that before. We'd never seen evidence of that before. Nobody's been really arrested for the theft of those drugs. This was just a completely new information to us, and it was not backed up by any fact or officer so-and-so told me this. So, you know, it was kind of a head-scratcher, some of these details.
Well, Pam, that's part of the challenge, I think, in covering and making sense of Governor Hogan. And as we've said many times on the show, we were certainly complimentary
in the beginning of the coronavirus and the way he handled it. But there are these things that happen, and it goes recently with his decision on making all local boards of elections send out requests for absentee ballots as opposed to just sending ballots again to everyone. And there's the issue with the test kits that I think people like you continue to scratch your head over. And it appears that we still don't have an answer on whether or not these 500,000 test kits that we got from South Korea, that appears to be a very admirable thing, whether they've been used effectively. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's correct. I just published another story about this. We've published several. I can't get any straight answers out of the Hogan administration, out of the health department, of how many of these tests have been used. They assert that they have been used, but they won't tell me how many or exactly where. And we also just learned this week, this was a scoop from Jane Miller over at Channel 11, that this initial batch of test kits, some of them were, quote, swapped out, and the state bought new ones to replace them from Lab Genomics in South Korea. I have asked how many and why and what the additional cost was to taxpayers, and I can't get that information out of the Hogan administration. So I'm not sure why not sharing this information. There could be very good reasons, whether they used, you know, maybe they're saving all of them for later, or they've used 10,000 or 100,000. You could explain. There could be a valid explanation behind really almost any number, but we're not getting that information, which not giving information is worse, I think, for most people than just giving the information, whatever it is.
Pam Wood is our guest. She's from the Baltimore Sun. She is furloughed, not furloughed, this week, next week, depending on when you hear this. We're discussing the Larry Hogan book as part of his second segment with Pamela Wood. I write this down because, you know, of my broken journalist heart. Can't get any answers, Pam. And Dom, when the journalist says, I can't get any answers, for you being a guy in government for a better part of two decades, when you can't get answers, defend that on Larry's side to say, I can't get you. I guess it's possible sometime to not have an answer, but this whole book looks like a political operative to me, right?
Well, I think that's what makes, and Pam can weigh in on this, I think that's what makes covering Governor Hogan very, very difficult. It's hard to get a sense at times, and we continue to invite Governor Hogan on Baltimore Positive. We'd love to discuss his book. We'd love to discuss the pandemic. We'd love to discuss his presidential aspirations. But what makes it difficult to me, and Pam, you speak to this as a journalist, is that there are different Larry Hogans. In other words, the Larry Hogan decided to make it difficult for Marylanders to vote in November is different than the Larry Hogan who wrote a scorching op-ed in the Washington Post. Different than the Larry Hogan that will talk about allegations that he paid $19 for a test kit when he could have bought them domestically for 10 or 12. Those are the kinds of contradictions that I find difficult in making sense of Larry Hogan. And Pam, maybe you talk about that from a journalist point of view.
Yeah, I mean, our job as journalists, no matter who we're covering, whether it's Governor Hogan or when I covered you, Don, or when I covered Kevin Kamenetz, is my job is to just get the information that people need to know so they can make their own decisions, form their own opinions, decide who they're going to vote for. And I see myself as the representative of the people, right? The 6 million Marylanders, very few of them have access to Governor Hogan. I do. Very few of them have access to the health secretary. I do. So I ask these questions that I think people need to know, and it's very frustrating when we can't always get answers. And this is what the local press does, the local newspaper reporters, TV, radio reporters. We're honing in on these details, and we're pointing out when we can't get information or when there's inconsistencies. It's very interesting to me to watch the national round of interviews, which the governor has been doing to promote this book, and they don't ask him the hard questions. A lot of their questions seem focused on just trying to get him to bash President Trump. And it's like, gosh, you could really be asking some good, useful questions about his management of the pandemic, frankly, which is important for everybody to know how governors are handling this. So it's very interesting to see these questions and maybe criticism or things that don't add up just kind of bounce off of him often and don't really stick, because it's only us local folks who are really honing in on it.
Well, you talk about a Teflon sort of, you know, veneer for him locally, and Don, you could speak to this as well. Gavin Newsom was doing a good job till he wasn't, right? Those idiots, those morons in Georgia and Florida, they looked fine before the tests came in the last 6 weeks or so, right? So Larry smells really good right now. I mean, you talk about sanitizing this coronavirus. If we were to get out of this, Maryland at this point would have done a pretty good job, so he would get a thumbs up for that. But you know as well as I do, you're a weekend at the beach away from all of a sudden having to shut the state back down again, right?
There is no doubt about it. And Nestor, I know that's a segue for you, because you've been texting me pretty nonstop about your frustration with the White House press briefings and the White House press secretary. And I know you wanted to chat with Pam.
Well, I mean, for both of you, right? I mean, I don't watch this anymore. Don, I stopped watching this circus early part of June. I mean, I couldn't stay with it. This new press secretary, and I'll let you speak to this, Pam, because I've dealt with press secretaries. Don was one of them. Kevin Byrne, I mean, in my sports world, setting up press conferences, having access to athletes or government or anyone, the front of what that is on a daily basis, and then the picture of the binder. And I guess this is where Larry Hogan comes in. Larry's Hogan name was on a defense binder in the Kaylee McEnany, whoever she is, her press briefing the other day. I find it fascinating that that's sort of their war book, you know, that the world got to look at these little tabs from 1965 that sit at the top of a binder that is basically the defense of Donald Trump all in one binder, right?
Hey, she's very organized, you know, that I gotta respect, right? I'm somebody who's organized, folders, highlighted things that peek behind the curtain to see that she had that binder. And you see her in these press conferences, somebody will, the reporter's not even finished asking the question and she's flipping through to get her, you know, her talking points and she can quote exactly. I mean, that's a sign of somebody who's well prepared with her answers on behalf of her boss. And, you know, certainly when we saw the photo go around in the Baltimore Sun newsroom, we were all sharing it. Look, there's a tab for Hogan. You know, we were fascinated by that.
Well, I mean, it's a book of enemies, right? Like, sort of like, you know, and the job of doing this, and Don, this is where I'd love to have you in. I mean, you had one of those books. I've seen Johnny O roll in next to me with one of those books. I don't work with one of those books. Most people don't. But the defense of all of the criticism, right? Like, and I guess that book gets pretty big when you're Donald Trump, and every single day the lies start to sort of stack up. I called it a binder of lies, because that's what it feels like to me as a citizen.
Well, yeah, I will jump in on that, because, and Nestor, you and I have had spirited discussions about this over the years. Having talking points, message point, that simply is good governance. You should try to communicate your message effectively. And it is easy to get off if you're not focused and disciplined. And your job, whether you're the principal, whether you're the press secretary, the chief of staff, or whether you're actually the public official at the time, is to try to communicate effectively with the public. In order to do that, you have to have a concise, very easy to comprehend series of message points. Now, that's different than refusing to answer questions or refusing to allow follow-up questions. You know, one of the really premier public information officers in the state for years was Bill Cooley at the Baltimore County Police Department. I mean, Bill will forever be remembered, God rest his soul, as the gentleman that walked out the night Joseph Pawlinski was finally shot and killed, and he simply addressed the press by saying, "Joseph Pawlinski is dead." You know, you can't be much more direct and succinct than that. But one of the things that Bill always drummed into everyone's head. And when he had interns or when he spoke to college classes, he would always say, think of yourself as a resource and make sure they, meaning the press, get it, that they understand. And Pam, you certainly sat in, and Nestor, I would give you the example. It was always our intention at budget time. I'll use that as a concrete example. To have members of the media in ahead of time, have them have an advanced copy of the budget, and be able to ask whatever questions they wanted to ask, because our goal was to have the Pam Woods or the Brian Searses or whoever else was covering the county at that time to understand the budget so that they could communicate it effectively. So I don't think the enemy is the talking point or message points. The enemy is whether you really are trying to be forthright and honest with the press, because I do view them as representing the people. Pam, I don't know, you can jump in on that.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends. So with Kayleigh McEnany, that's a binder full of spin. Frankly,
oh, yeah.
other you know, governors and county executives, mayors, more often those binders are full of information, more often that maybe spin too. But you know, one thing that I, as a journalist, respect and I'm glad I don't have to do is that often press secretaries or executives at these press conferences get asked about 10 different topics at once, and they need to know answers off the top of our heads, especially in my case, in the General Assembly session. There's thousands of pieces of legislation. The governor holds a press conference about, say, crime, his crime bills. Well, we're going to throw at him questions about, you know, restoring the Chesapeake Bay, or, you know, budget cuts that affect Howard County, or any number of things, and you have to think on your feet and have information ready. So having a well-prepared either executive or press secretary certainly is helpful, because I know I could not answer that many things.
Well, I would say, having been a guy on the other end of this asking the questions all the time, I never have a problem with anybody saying, I can't tell you that because it's privileged information in my business, or I'll get you an answer on that. I don't know the answer, and I don't want to guess from a podium on a live mic. I don't want to. I don't want to be general. I want to be specific. You know, find me on Friday, and I'll get my department. We'll get that answer for you. I have no problem with that. What I do have a problem with is looking me in the eye as a journalist, and I guess this goes back. We'll wind up on your furlough before this is all over with. The insulting part for me, and what I always tried to get through to my audience back in the 90s when Angelos was lying on a daily basis, is saying, because he lies, I can put that in the paper and put it in a quote and make it his lie. I can't accept it as a fact, as my lie. And part of that is the acceptance of 36-38% of the world to believe whatever. I mean, we found that Fox News challenged him this week. Fox News is the only one with access to him, right? So when Fox News sits out in the Rose Garden and says, oh, Joe Biden didn't say that, and they stop the tape and he acts like an adolescent and finds out that he's wrong, he's never wrong, by the way, but when that happens, that only happens when a journalist doesn't back down. And no one's going in there with guns and militia, you know, on Donald Trump at this point. The only one going in with anything are media members. And once you back down, it's over. And his whole game was to intimidate Wee Gee Yang and intimidate the men, intimidate the women, insult the African Americans. I mean, that's the game. And it's disgusting. It's revolting. But until someone steps up and says, that's a lie, that's not a fact, and we're going to hold the camera until you prove it, or until I prove you, which is pretty much what happened toward the weekend. I mean, that's a big story when Chris Wallace holds up Donald Trump and says, he lied to me, right? I mean, that's something Fox News has been unable to do.
Well, I guess this all just goes to the importance of, you know, having a strong and free press that, you know, we take the information and we tell you what we know, and we can just clearly say this is what the president said, or this is what this official said, this is what the facts are. And because if we're not doing that, I don't know who is trustworthy, right? Because if you have political opponents, you know, they're maybe not as trustworthy. We're on nobody's side as journalists. I'm on the side of the truth. I'm on the side of the information. And, that's what my allegiance is to, and that's why it's important that we have a robust press in our country.
There's no doubt about that. Save Our Son and Pamela Wood, our guest here, for part two in the aftermath of the Hogan book release. Don Mohler's here, former county executive in Baltimore County. Last thing, and I'll leave this open for you. You're about to go on a furlough. You were working with us. You're sort of working with us right now on behalf of the Baltimore Sun. We talked about the importance of all of this, and as these weeks stack up and Larry Hogan makes assertions that may or may not be true, as more things happen in the coronavirus next week, as there's more testing, we need journalists like you, like Baltimore Sun journalists, like TV journalists, like Jane Miller, like the pit bull that I once was, out in front of all of this for government leading up into November, and you're on a furlough this week. I want to give you a little oxygen to talk about Save Our Son, because I do think it's important that people are challenging Larry Hogan and Johnny O and Barry Glassman and down the line. Calvin Ball will go through any of them, and certainly Brandon Scott in the future, and I plan to be a part of that because it's where I live and why I got involved in trying to make Baltimore better. But for you, furlough this week, you don't get paid, questions don't get asked. It's a terrible, terrible thing what's happened to journalism. And I know back in our first segment, Pam, I told you all I ever wanted to be was John Stedman. All I ever wanted to do was be the guy in the sports section of your newspaper.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. We talked about this in the first segment. SaveOurBaltimoreSun.com is a campaign put forward by the News Guild. That's the union that represents Baltimore Sun reporters and photographers and our ad sales team. Also, our community newspapers are represented by the News Guild. We're trying to get the corporate owners to sell the Baltimore Sun and sell our community newspapers. We believe they'd be better off as independent, nonprofit news organizations. Take that profit motive off the table. Take the rich investor people who own our company and who don't care about journalism. Take that part out of the equation so we can focus on our mission. Any profits reinvested back into the paper. We're pressuring the Tribune Publishing Board. That's our parent company. We're trying to get them to come to the table. We have local philanthropy groups willing to put up money to buy us if only Tribune will sell. So we're encouraging people to sign on to our campaign at SaveOurBaltimoreSun.com because this is really untenable. I've been off 3 weeks out of six. And I'm our only state government reporter right now at a time when our state government, what our governor's doing, what our health department is doing, how we're handling the pandemic, what's going to happen with policing reform, budget cuts that are coming from this economic collapse. I've been sidelined for 3 out of 6 weeks, sitting at home, not getting paid, going through the unemployment system, and really that doesn't help anybody. So we really want to turn that around. So I encourage people to check out us again at SaveOurBaltimoreSun.com.
I can't even add anything to that, Pam. Honestly, I mean, perfect speech. Go ahead, Don.
Well, it's just Pam, speaking of that, you're trying to make sense of all this. Does Kerwin survive?
That's a big question. So Kerwin, for those who aren't familiar, is a really ambitious, sweeping education reform plan. It also reworks funding that the state will give to local school districts. Local school districts are jointly funded by the state and the city or county. Yet it was passed. It was vetoed by the governor. Democratic lawmakers really want to see this through. Now more than ever, they say, we really need to invest in our children and we need to give them the proper education so that they're prepared for careers or college. The problem is, where's the money going to come from? If they override this and put it into law next session, where do they get the money at a time when government has way less money because of the pandemic? There is a provision in the Kerwin bill, if it is overridden and becomes law, that puts a pause on some of the funding increases if certain economic indicators are met, which has happened because of the downturn. I wouldn't be surprised if we see the General Assembly override the veto, put Kerwin into effect, and then perhaps have follow-up legislation to adjust some of it. Maybe slow down some of the implementation, maybe prioritize certain programs. I think that's a discussion to be had that we'll see in the next 6 months or so.
We had Bill Ferguson on last week talking about it, and you can find that out at Baltimore Positive. And he's still bullish, as I know he is, right, Don?
Absolutely bullish and on Kerwin. And really, my last question about the General Assembly is, talk to us about what was different in terms of covering it without the two mics who had been there for decades.
Yeah, 2020 was a remarkable session for many reasons. On one end, it ended early for the first time since the Civil War due to the pandemic. But it started with new leadership in both chambers. Senate President Bill Ferguson and House Speaker Adrian Jones, because last spring, House Speaker Mike Bush had died, and in the fall, Senate President Mike Miller said he was stepping back to be just a regular senator, although he'll never be a regular senator, as he is in treatment for cancer. So it had been the mics, Mike Miller, Mike Bush, for as long as almost my entire career as a reporter. So I'd never seen anything else. That most of the lawmakers had never seen any other leadership besides Mike Bush and Mike Miller. So we saw Speaker Jones and President Ferguson really finding their way. I think they both were thoughtful about their approach. They didn't come in and, turn the tables upside down. But they, were sort of feeling their way. They made some, changes in the leadership. And I find both of them to be a little more deferential to the members, like a little less, yes, I'm going to support it. And so then everybody knows whatever it is going to happen. I think they were a little bit more, we'll see what the body wants to do and we'll consider options, and not so much saying for sure that, XYZ is what we're going to do. It's very interesting to see. And then what your cue is going to be in 2021 now they've settled in more to their roles. Are they going to be more vocal and directing things a little more? Will be interesting to watch.
Pam, yeah. Go ahead, Don.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's one last question, producer, for Pam, and I know it's a difficult one. It's now been over a year since the horrific shooting at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis. You had a very close bond with the Gazette and with folks there. I just wonder if you can take us back to that day and that experience and what it's meant to you as you look back now a year later.
Yeah, so when I came out of college in 2000, I started out at the Maryland Gazette, a community newspaper, and I was there for a few years, then moved over to the Capitol in Annapolis until I went to the Sun in 2013. So the first 13 years of my career, I was with this company. I loved covering Anne Arundel County and working for those papers. I still maintain friendships with folks at the Capitol, as well as professionally, we work together. And so the murders on June 28th, 2018, four of the five people who were murdered were people I knew and worked with and liked very much. So it was really difficult. I was actually at the Baltimore County Board of Elections in Hunt Valley when it happened. It was right after the primary election. And so there was counting absentee ballots for the John Olszewski, Jim Broach, and Vicki Almond primary. So it was a day I'll never forget. It was really something unfathomable, and still to this day, it sort of doesn't seem real. But for someone to come in and attack a newsroom for an old grudge was just, it would have been shocking if I didn't know, the place, if I didn't know the people, if this wasn't my world, it certainly would have been shocking. And it's been difficult since then, because the legal process is still not resolved. We're still, and it was delayed further by the pandemic. The person who did this, pleaded guilty, and we're waiting on trial about his criminal responsibility for it to find out what happens to him. So that is planned for later this year. So it's certainly been a difficult road for the broad, Capitol family.
Pam, for me, every time I see the Orange Menace start to talk about enemy of the people and vilifying people for asking for truth. I think about that because I knew two of those folks. So, you know, for all of us who've been involved in journalism, it's sort of a worst nightmare come to life. And to your point, it never ends. You know, it's not about one day. It's about every day after that day. Pamela Wood is here. She is furloughed, but I highly, highly recommend you follow her out on Twitter at P. Wood Reporter. She's there. She's at the Baltimore Sun. Don, I'll give you parting shot from the Eastern Shore. Go for it.
No, I just want to say, Pam, thank you, and keep up the good work. It's remarkable to me, and I want people to understand the assault on the First Amendment. When you see yourself getting furloughed, Dan Roderick's getting furloughed, Peter Jensen and the editorial staff getting furloughed, this is not the kind of journalism we need. It's outrageous. We need to save the side, get involved, go to the website. Let's make sure that Baltimore, Maryland, and the region has a paper it can be proud of for years to come, where reporters aren't sitting home when they have important stories to cover.
SaveOurBaltimoreSun.com, the way to find that. You can find Pamela Wood at P. Wood Reporter. Pam, thanks for circling back for a second segment to go with the first segment. And we had pre-Hogan book stuff in the first segment, post-Hogan book stuff in the second segment. Hopefully there's a third segment down the line where you get a 52-week work cycle. Or actually, maybe about 46, 47 to give you a few weeks off. How about that, all right?
Sounds good to me. Thank you both so much for having me. This was fun.
Pam, appreciate you. Pamela Wood, one of the great journalists here in the state of Maryland, covering Annapolis and covering all sorts of things: education, our safety, our health, our government, the integrity of our government, which is pretty important because I live in Baltimore City. That's why we did Baltimore Positive, and conversations like that. Don Moeller and I coming together to talk to all sorts of folks. If you go out to Baltimore Positive right now, to our repository in the buyatoyota.com audio vault or at WNST.net, merging all of it into one great pipeline that will become local. And WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, we never stop being Baltimore Positive.